From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould says it's a mistake to see evolution as a logical march of progress leading up to the creation of human intelligence. In fact, he says, the world could have turned out very differently without humans. On today's Fresh Air, Stephen Jay Gould tells us how we almost didn't get here. Also today, anthropologist Richard Nelson tells us about a place humans still haven't gotten to, the island he explored in the Pacific Northwest. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from NRBQ and Peter Stamfel. And book critic Maureen Corrigan examines the book world's trade journal, Publishers Weekly. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The East German government announced today that East Germans who want to leave the country can do so freely through all checkpoints between East and West Berlin and East and West Germany. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Berlin.
The announcement came late in a press conference given by Communist Party spokesman Günter Schabowski in Berlin. No longer will anyone have to give any reasons for leaving, Schabowski told stunned reporters. Police now have orders to give travel permits immediately, no questions asked. East Germans no longer need to travel to third countries to get to West Germany, Schabowski continued. All the checkpoints between the two Germanies and within Berlin will be open. Schabowski's press conference was broadcast live on East German television, and less than a half hour later, the lifting of the travel restrictions was the lead news item here. The flood of East German refugees through Czechoslovakia has doubled this week to more than 11,000 a day. I'm Mike Schuster in Berlin.
West German Chancellor Helmut Kohl said tonight he might have to break off his visit to Poland to return home because of the latest developments. There was a subdued reaction from the White House. President Bush said he welcomes the announcement, which he called a dynamic development. He said his administration was prepared to give the government of West Germany maximum help to accommodate the influx of East Germans. According to reports from a television station in Atlanta, a military jet crashed today into an apartment complex near the city. Atlanta-based station WSB reported that the jet, apparently from nearby Dobbins Air Force Base, crashed into Regency Square Apartments off the city's heavily traveled Windy Hill Road. The station reported there are two injuries at the complex and said the jet's pilot parachuted from the plane, was injured and taken to an area hospital, and the extent of the pilot's injuries are not known. Negotiations aimed at ending the war in Nicaragua began this afternoon at the United Nations in New York. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The Nicaraguan government is offering what it calls a negotiable plan. If the Contras disarm by the end of November, the government will implement a ceasefire and guarantee the safety and political rights of the Contras. The government is also offering to grant amnesty to Contra prisoners after half the rebel army demobilizes. The Contras have made a counteroffer that calls for an immediate ceasefire first and a longer period for verifying an end to the fighting before they disarm. The talks are scheduled to run through tomorrow and could stretch to Saturday. The Nicaraguan delegation has been instructed not to leave the bargaining table until an agreement is reached. I'm Richard Gonzalez in New York.
The House today voted to give a tax break to investors by cutting the capital gains tax rate. But the act may have as part of a deal to send the measure to the Senate, where it is almost certain to be defeated. President Bush began pushing the cut in capital gains during the campaign last year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 19 points. It closed the day at 2603.69. This is NPR News. The White House said today President Bush will meet with Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir next week. At the White House, they will discuss Middle East peace efforts. Although it had been known for months Shamir would be visiting Washington, the White House had declined to say whether he would meet with President Bush. It was widely interpreted as a show of U.S. anger over Israel's position on a U.S.-sponsored peace proposal. David Dinkins, mayor-elect of New York, and Douglas Wilder, the projected winner in Virginia's governor's race, visited Capitol Hill today to talk about their victories and what they mean for the Democratic Party. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
David Dinkins and Douglas Wilder were joined by the Speaker of the House, Thomas Foley, and the Senate Majority Leader, George Mitchell, to say that the Democrats are back, But while they downplayed the race factor, the New York mayor's contest and the Virginia governor's election were marked by a defection of white Democratic voters. In New York, 7 out of 10 Jewish Democratic voters voted for Michael Dukakis in 1988, but only 3 out of 10 did so for mayor-elect David Dinkins. In Virginia, Wilder did not do as well among whites as his white Democratic ticket mates. Despite this, he said voters are voting principle, not color.
And I think you'll find that qualifications, merit, experience, and leadership capabilities are the hallmarks by which people will be judging candidates.
Wilder should know next week whether or not there will be a recount in Virginia. His opponent, Marshall Coleman, has said he will only insist on one if the state pays for it. I'm Jackie Leiden in Washington.
Galileo spacecraft fired its thrusters today, 3 weeks after its launch from the shuttle Atlantis. It was the first of about 30 course changes needed for Galileo's 6-year trip to Jupiter. The trajectory change is meant to aim Galileo for its flight past Venus in February. The spacecraft will pass by Venus once and Earth twice. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould has been a formidable opponent of the creationists, but he's also challenged the work of traditional Darwinians. Darwin, he says, has been misunderstood, misquoted, and misapplied. Gould has reinterpreted Darwin and written about evolutionary theory in his Natural History magazine column and in a series of popular books. He's won the National Book Critics Circle Award, the American Book Award, and a MacArthur Award. He's a professor of geology at Harvard. Gould's new book is about the Burgess Shale, a quarry in British Columbia with fossils dating back more than 500 million years. According to Gould, this is the most precious and important fossil collection because it's revised our view of life and because the fossils themselves are objects of exquisite beauty. Gould studies evolutionary biology because it gets to the big questions like, where did we come from and what does it all mean? But he's careful to not project an egocentric human perspective onto natural history.
Because we're so driven by our need for psychological comfort, solace, etc., to see the history of life in human terms, that we inappropriately tried to take this vast pageant of 3.5 billion years of life's history and tell the story of its changes as though it's all meant to validate the eventual appearance of human intelligence on the planet. In fact, human beings, in the form of our current species, have been around for less than 1 million years, and the whole lineage is only 6 million years old, so we're a tiny little twig and afterthought. Nature was not made for us.
One of the theories that you've been challenging for many years now is the what you call the march of progress. And we've all seen the picture of the evolutionary sequence of caveman to modern man, where there's like 8 or so different sketches, and in each sketch, man becomes a little more erect, loses some of the chest hair, and has a more developed head.
And unconsciously, in the racist tradition, the skin becomes lighter.
Right, so. Right. No, exactly. And you say that that it really isn't that way at all, that evolution isn't this orderly progression.
Certainly not. It's a luxuriantly branching bush whose bifurcations have no particular predictability, and if you could plant the seed and let the tree grow again, it would produce another branching bush, but one of entirely different form and properties, which undoubtedly would not include the eventual evolution of consciousness in human form. It's not a direct prediction of Darwin's theory of natural selection that there should be this kind of predictably progressive order. I think we've read that into the story of evolution from our cultural hopes. Nor do most educated people believe the ladder of progress in its naively simple form of a single sequence. But though they don't think they accept that, there are so many of its implications that are current that in a way it still strongly impacts the way we see evolution.
How do you think that image, the ladder of progress image, affects the way we see evolution now and affects the way we see other issues today?
Oh, mainly in terms of how we continually see the eventual appearance of human life as something predictably necessary. Again, we're a tiny little twig of the primate branch of the mammalian tree of the vertebrate lineage. And even vertebrates are here by contingent good fortune. And so all of the later lineages surely are. That's the main way. But there are many other actually curious biases. For example, take your classical story of the evolution of the horse. Everybody's seen that when little Eohippus marches into the future and becomes the modern racehorse. But the only reason why we choose examples like that is that we're trying to linearize the true bush of evolution to the ladder of progress. You see, horses have been a very unsuccessful lineage in evolutionary terms. There's only one species left of what was once a luxurious bush, and yet we are driven by the bias of the ladder of progress to seek these truly unsuccessful lineages in the true sense of diversity and tell our evolutionary story that way, because there's only one left. We can see it as the crown of a process leading in that direction rather as the single surviving twig. There's never a classical evolutionary story about the evolution of antelopes or of rodents or of bats. Those are the great success stories of mammalian evolution, the truly successful lineages with hundreds to thousands of species.
So instead of seeing evolution as the slow process of perfecting a species, you say that there's sudden change, sudden, improbable, unpredictable change that accounts for new species and for changes within species.
Sudden is a geologically
right.
relative term. I don't mean overnight.
Right.
Thousands to millions relative to billions. Yes, most of the time in evolution, nothing much is happening. There's this old quip about the life of a soldier, that it consists of long periods of boredom interspersed with short moments of terror. And the history of life, I think, is very much that way. Most of the time, nothing much is happening. There's a lot of stability. There are episodes, again, not overnight episodes, geological episodes of rapid change, either mass extinction events or the periods of explosive diversification that tend to follow from them, during which there's a lot of chanciness. Who dies in a mass extinction, particularly if some of them are triggered by extraterrestrial impact, as now seems probable, cannot be a predictable result of the perfecting properties of natural selection. It has to be, in part, the luck of the draw.
So does this mean that human beings aren't constantly evolving towards a more perfect species, that we're not always evolving toward becoming more intelligent and more physically well-endowed?
Well, I won't deny that there's a long-term trend, and I don't have a particularly unconventional reading of it. Yes, if you look to the branching off of the human lineage 6 million years ago, of course there's a trend towards increasing brain size, and I assume that has something to do with the value of consciousness. Nonetheless, what you imply in the question is true. The human species, Homo sapiens, us, evolved about 250,000 years ago, probably, from biochemical evidence. The first fossils are 100,000 or so years old, and there's been no change in the physical body form, brain size, or shape of humans in at least the last 30,000 years. We have good evidence. The people who painted the caves at Lascaux and Altamira are us, and that's pre-agriculture, which means that everything that we call civilization from the origin of agriculture on up has been built by people with unchanged bodies and brains, which does testify to the enormous latent capacity of the evolved human brain, but does also indicate that the progressive character of technology, which I would not deny, I don't mean necessarily good, I mean progressive in the sense that it builds towards something that wasn't before, has been done with unchanged brain and body.
Are you challenging the theory of the survival of the fittest, which is not only an evolutionary theory, but it's really become a metaphor for the way a lot of people see their lives?
I certainly challenge it as a metaphor. It's, after all, first of all, it's only a metaphorical phrase to describe Darwin's process of natural selection. In some ways, it's an unfortunate phrase. Darwin got it from Spencer. The word fit is ambiguous in Darwinian theory. Fitness is really reproductive success. The creatures that are successful in Darwin's world are those that leave more surviving offspring for whatever reason. It doesn't have to be prowess in battle or competition in the overt sense of warfare. And that's why so many of the metaphorical uses in cultural change are so wrong-headed. You can't use natural selection as a metaphor to validate war, imperialism, racism, poverty, whatever had been done in the past, not so much now, because those are based on the false notion that those who hold the power of the gun are superior in Darwin's sense, and that's not what Darwin meant. Again, the theory of natural selection is about leaving surviving offspring, and that's all.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's very funny you mentioned in your new book that although you've challenged the whole idea of the ladder of progress in human evolution, four editions of your books have used that ladder of progress as the cover illustration. So how did you handle that? Yeah, go ahead.
It's such a common metaphor. These are all foreign translations. Mm-hmm. I have no control whatever over the artwork on foreign translations of my books. I know what happens. The French editor goes to the artist and says, hey, we got a book on evolution. Draw me something. Artist doesn't read the book. What does evolution mean? It means the ladder of progress. So on the cover appears the four-footed ape leading up to the man, because there's gender bias there too, the man in the business suit. And I have no, what can I do about it? If you read the content of the book, it's dedicated to debunking that metaphor, but one smiles. You can either smile or cry, and there's so many things in life that have those reactions, and if you can laugh, it's better.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your work with evolutionary theory, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is Stephen Jay Gould. He's an evolutionary biologist, a paleontologist, and a popular science writer. His new book, Wonderful Life, is about evolutionary theory, looking at the fossils in the Burgess Shale. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Stephen Jay Gould is my guest. He's an evolutionary biologist, a paleontologist, and science writer. And his new book is called Wonderful Life, The Burgess Shale and the Nature of History. Let's talk about the Burgess Shale. Now, this is basically a huge collection of fossils, a whole fossil shelf, fossil ledge.
Hundreds of drawers of it. It's a quarry about the length of a city block in British Columbia. Briefly, its significance is this. Every once in a while, luckily, in the fossil record, you get extraordinary preservation with soft parts intact. You realize that most conventional fossils are only the hard parts of organisms, the shells, the bones. Not very informative. Most animals don't have soft parts. Pardon me, most animals don't have hard parts, and hard parts are often very uninformative. What could you learn about the anatomy of a snail if you only had its shell? Blessedly little. So every once in a while, when geological circumstances conspire to preserve soft parts, we get a precious window into the true diversity of life at some ancient time. Now, the reason why the Burgess Shale, which is a quarry in British Columbia, is so important is simply this. There is one transcendently major, magnificent moment, if you will, in the history of life, which occurred, and again, it's a geological moment lasting a few million years, about 570 million years ago. It's called the Cambrian Explosion. Life on Earth is 3.5 billion years old by fossil evidence. But 5/6 of that history is the history of single-celled creatures only. Essentially, all modern anatomical designs of multicellular organisms first appear in the fossil record in this few million-year period called the Cambrian Explosion about 570 million years ago. That's the most important moment in the history of life. And the Burgess Shale happens to be the only soft-bodied fauna we have right after that time. It's the only insight we have into the true diversity produced by that cardinal moment in the history of life. That's why it's so important. It was discovered in 1909 by a great paleontologist, C.D. Walcott, who was head of the Smithsonian Institution, one of the most powerful men in American science. He was such a deeply conservative, traditional thinker that he interpreted these wonderful Burgess Shale fossils in such a conventional manner that we didn't learn anything new about the history of life, and that's why they're not well known to the public, because in Walcott's conventionalized interpretation, in short, he shoehorned all of them into modern groups. He called some of them annelids, segmented worms, some arthropods, and all of them were primitive precursors of things that came later, thereby making that conventional statement that life starts with a few simple primitive things, moves upward and outward in a predictable fashion, eventually to incarnate itself in human intelligence. About 20 years ago, a major restudy of the Burgess Shale was initiated, not because anyone expected to find anything unusual, more for very properly chauvinistic reasons. The Canadian Geological Survey, quite disturbed, following a perennial theme in Canadian-American relations, that this most precious of Canada's fossil heritage was sitting in drawers in Washington, decided to have it restudied, especially since their mappers were out in that region anyway. They hired Harry Whittington, the world's greatest expert on fossil arthropods, my predecessor at Harvard, to do the work. Harry didn't expect to find anything unusual. He thought he'd spend a few years describing some fossil arthropods. Instead, he spent 20 years, he and two brilliant students, Derek Briggs and Simon Conway Morris, and ended up with an entirely new interpretation of the history of life. What they found, I can summarize it very briefly, is that, in fact, although the Burgess Shale is just a quarry, a city block long, and doesn't have that many species in it, there is more diversity in terms of basic anatomical designs in that single quarry than in all the world's oceans today. For example, this is called the age of mammals in textbooks. That's chauvinism. It's really the age of arthropods. There's a million species of insects out there. Arthropods greatly dominate the history of life of multicellular creatures, yet all modern arthropods, for that magnificent diversity, fit into only three groups in terms of basic anatomy. There's the insect group, the spider scorpion group, and the crustacean group. In the Burgess Shale, there are 20 additional possibilities of arthropod design. One quarry in British Columbia, far fewer species. In the Burgess Shale, there are 15 to 20 kinds of organisms that have no modern analog at all. They just look weird. They didn't make it. There's one animal called Opabinia, which has five eyes and a vacuum cleaner-like nozzle sticking out its front end. There's a creature so bizarre that it was officially called Hallucigenia in Latin to specify its strangeness. Now, you can give that a conventional interpretation. You can say, all right, that was a great era of experimentation. In eras of experimentation, there's lots of accidents and junk produced. The good guys won. The bad guys lost. The ones who didn't live had inferior anatomy or were overly specialized. And so there's still a predictability about life's history. But after studying these creatures for 20 years, Whittington and his colleagues see nothing about those who didn't make it that in any way distinguishes them from the fortunate survivors and condemns them to defeat, from which I think one has to assume that maximal diversity was reached right at the beginning, that we then had a grand-scale kind of lottery to sort out the victors, which means that if you could replay the tape of life, that's the metaphor I like to use, start it again in the Burgess Shale, you'd get a totally different result every time. There are 17 trillion ways to take combinations of 10 items out of pools of 100. And that's probably about the right order, 1 in 10, for survivorship of anatomical designs in the Burgess Shale. Moreover, one last point, you can say, well, I don't care about that because I don't give a damn if the invertebrate life of the world was different today from what actually happened, because I don't care about invertebrates. Every once in a while I eat a lobster, a swat, a fly, but fundamentally, who cares? But you really ought to care, you see, because one of the animals in the Burgess Shale is named Pikaia, and it's the first chordate. That is, it's the first member of our group. Now, I'm not saying that Pikaia was our direct ancestor or the only chordate living then, but I'm sure that chordates were not a conspicuously successful group back in the Burgess Shale. Most of the replays of life's tape would not include the survival of Pikaia, and if it and its group did not make it, we wouldn't be here. You'd still have a sensible history. It would still be perfectly explainable. I'm not saying life is capricious. I'm just saying it has billions of alternative routes, only one of which is taken. Any other route would have made just as much sense, except there probably wouldn't have been any conscious creature to chronicle it.
So you're saying that there's really as much chance as there is logic to which species survive?
Oh, yes, in that grand historical sense. That's the way we interpret history. We all know that the Battle of Gettysburg could have gone either way, and if it had gone the other way, the South might well have won the Civil War, and we'd have two nations instead of one, and you and me never would have had to memorize 47 years ago, etc., which might have made our education a little less painful, but the American history would have been totally different. And we're comfortable with that kind of chanciness, which we call contingency, in historical explanation. We know it applies. And yet when we do science, we think that science is about predictable, law-like behavior. But there's much about the narrative character of the history of life and many of the sciences which deal in historical reconstruction that has the same character as historical explanation itself.
How was evolutionary theory taught to you when you were in junior high or high school?
Oh, not very much. And that's the legacy of the Scopes trial of the 20s. I used a book, Moon Man and Otto, which was the standard biology textbook. I think it had almost 80% of the market at the time. Oh, evolution was there, mind you. It wasn't illegal or anything. But it was chapter 60 of a 66-chapter book, which, if you remember the realities of high school education, means that most teachers never got to it. And it wasn't called evolution. It was called The Hypothesis of Racial Development.
Oh, really?
That kind of succumbed. And this was New York City. This was, you know, there was no reason not to teach evolution. There's no animus against it. It was just that he was a national edition, which had been dumbed down this way because of the legacy of Scopes and creation. Now, things got much better after the Sputnik went up, because after the Sputnik went up in 1955, and for chauvinistic reasons, we realized we had to get on the stick with educational values, there was a vast program throughout the country to improve science education, which led to some very good textbooks that treated evolution well, and they're still on the market. But no, I had to get it all by personal interest. It wasn't until I got to college that I was ever taught properly about evolution, which is so ironic and nonsensical, because evolution is the fundamental integrating concept of the biological sciences.
Is there a question related to evolution that you would most like to be able to answer?
Oh, yes. It actually involves the Burgess Shale. You see, my book shamefully avoids one of the two great questions. My book is about, having gotten this enormous diversity of the Burgess Shale, how is it that only few of the possibilities survive? In other words, it's about the extinction of the Burgess faunas and the patterns of its extinction. I leave aside, simply because I don't have any good ideas about it, neither does anybody else, the equally interesting question of how in heaven's name you got all that diversity so quickly in the first place. No, I would love to have better information on the forces behind these periods of explosive diversification. My book doesn't ignore it. It's too important issue to ignore it. It has a few pages, but there just isn't much insight that we can offer.
And why not? And I mean, what are the obstacles to offering a good hypothesis about why has there been so much diversity in that period?
The main problem is probably, and this is somewhat pessimistic because I don't really know how to get around it, is that one would have to know something more about the nature of genetic systems. We'd need to know whether there's a kind of evolution in genetic systems as well as in the forms of organisms. Could it be that genetic systems were organized somewhat differently as to be more capable of rapid and extensive change? It's so interesting that no new phyla, no major groups of organisms have arisen since the time of the Cambrian period and the Burgess Shale. Lots of backing and forthing, lots of variation. But the only phylum that doesn't have a record in the Cambrian is the bryozoans, a very small group of marine invertebrates. So there's definitely a story there. And until we get some way of making inferences about genetic systems of extinct creatures, which seems very hard to do because genes don't fossilize, I don't really quite know how to get at it.
Your book includes illustrations that show how some of these extinct species might have looked when they lived. Illustrations based on what the fossils tell us. Can you give an example of one of the species that you'd most like to actually have seen because it seems so intriguing from the evidence?
Oh, yes. I think my favorite is an animal called Anomalocaris, which literally means the odd shrimp. And it's very odd, but it's not a shrimp. It's a member of some unknown group. It intrigues me particularly because Walcott so completely mistook it. It's the largest animal of the Cambrian period. It's up to 3 feet long. Much bigger. Most of these other Burgess Shale creatures are a few inches long. Walcott completely misunderstood it. He took various parts of it. One part he called a jellyfish. Another part he called a sea cucumber. That's an echinoderm. Another part he called an arthropod. Turns out all these pieces go together. The part that Walcott had called the jellyfish is actually the mouth of the creature. The part that he called an arthropod, he thought it was a pencil-like thing with segments, is one of a pair of feeding appendages. The part that he called a sea cucumber is the body. Now, this creature, Anomalocaris, was 3 feet long. It had a circular mouth on its underside, operating on a constriction nutcracker principle, unlike anything alive today. It had a pair of feeding appendages sticking off the front end that brought food around into this creature. And then the back end, the main part of the body, was a triangular-shaped, bellows-like apparatus. That's my favorite. I guess my second favorite is Opabinia, which had 5 eyes. I think I mentioned this before, and this vacuum cleaner-like nozzle, which is probably a food-collecting device sticking out the front end. There are some weird and wonderful creatures in the Burgess Shale.
Well, Stephen Jay Gould, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks very much.
Stephen Jay Gould's new book is called Wonderful Life, The Burgess Shale and the Nature of History. Gould teaches biology, geology, and the history of science at Harvard. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, former First Lady Nancy Reagan. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. He won't say exactly where it is, but anthropologist Richard Nelson lives near an island in the Pacific Northwest, an island with no people, but an abundance of wildlife. He's devoted the last few years to exploring and writing about this island. Coming up, Nelson tells us how his explorations have been influenced by the Native Americans he's lived with and studied. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums from two veteran groups with cult followings, NRBQ and Peter Stamfel and the Bottle Caps. And for decades now, the first word on new books has come from the magazine Publishers Weekly. Critic Maureen Corrigan analyzes the publishing world as represented by PW. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. After a day of fast-moving and dramatic developments, the East German government announced tonight that all East Germans are free immediately to travel out of the country. Earlier today, East German officials said the country is opening its borders so that citizens may travel at will. Open borders and free elections have been the two main demands of a growing protest movement in East Germany, as over 200,000 people have fled to the West this year. Deidre Berger reports from West Berlin on reaction there.
The West Berlin mayor, Walter Mumper, called the decision a historic moment for the city. He warned the expected flood of visitors and emigres the next few days will strain city services, but he asked the West Berliners to welcome the East Germans with open arms. Top city government officials in West Berlin are meeting tonight to draw up measures to deal with the situation. West German police say more than 100 East Germans have already crossed the border, but the first major wave of visitors is expected tomorrow morning. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in West Berlin.
West German Chancellor Kohl said today that he might have to break off his visit to Poland to return home and take charge of a dramatic situation after East Germany's decision to open its borders with West Germany. A military jet crashed into an apartment complex in Smyrna, Georgia this evening. There are reports of at least two people injured. The crash caused a large fire. According to WSB Television in Atlanta, the jet crashed into Pine Village Apartments off of Windy Hill Road, a heavily traveled thoroughfare. The station said that the jet's pilot parachuted from the plane, was injured, and taken to an area hospital. In Iran, a newspaper close to the president and foreign ministry has dashed any hopes that Americans' release of frozen Iranian assets will help solve the hostage crisis. Mike Theodula reports.
Washington still had to show a lot more goodwill, the Tehran Times said, before Iran would use its influence with the kidnappers in Lebanon who are holding eight Americans hostage. The release of its funds, frozen a decade ago when students in Tehran seized the American embassy, has always been Iran's key demand in helping to end the hostage crisis. Now that a large proportion of these has been released, it looks like Iran might demand a different show of goodwill from Washington, such as giving less support to Israel. The Tehran Times said Iran was very concerned that America continue to help those who suppress Muslims and their rights. It referred in particular to a recent decision by America to veto the establishment of a United Nations inquiry into Israel's collection of taxes in the occupied territories. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 19.5 points to close at 2,603.69, on by some 143 million shares. Declining issues led advances 8-6 in only moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. A musician's desire to be commercially successful and be true to his or her artistic sensibilities need not be mutually exclusive. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of two new albums that he says illustrates this point.
Way,
Peter Stanfill and NRBQ have more in common than just the fact that they're both cult acts with high critical esteem. Their new albums arrive after long silences, 3 years for Stanfill, 6 years since NRBQ's last studio album. And both records prove to be the most commercial efforts these acts have ever attempted. The nice thing is that catchy tunes and playful lyrics don't seem to have obscured these musicians' trademark obscurity.
Here's a story about a special girl, born into an ordinary world, with a gift she could not wait to share. Folks were just like you and me, little angel was all they'd see, not a hint of what they should beware.
That's Peter Stanfill and his band The Bottle Caps from their new album, The People's Republic of Rock and Roll. Right away, you can hear why Stanfill isn't giving Janet Jackson and Fine Young Cannibals any competition. Stanfill's hoarse, quavery voice is an acquired sound. But like all first-rate rock singers, Stanfill makes his limitations work for him. In this case, his yowl connects with predecessors ranging from old blues singers to the more expressive heavy metal howlers. Stanfill's history goes back to the 60s, when he was part of the legendary Holy Modal Rounders, which at one point included Sam Shepard on drums. The Rounders' music sounded a lot like the stuff Peter Stanfill is making now at age 50. On a new song like Bridge and Tunnel Girls, Stanfill and the Bottle Caps locate the common ground between the Ramones, Johnny Cash, and the Rivingtons' Papa Oomau Mau.
Downtown post-punk girls are mighty cool, and them Chelsea girls with their purple curls almost make me drool. There's East Side girls and West Side girls and Village girls galore. Manhattan girls are fine, fine girls, but the ones that I adore come from over and under the Hudson and over and under the East, from the Barrens and the Narrows, through the banks of Newtown Creek, from the green, green hills of the Jersey Shore, where they shoot the Atlantic curls. Hey, what I mean, the whole damn scene is Bridge and Tunnel Girls.
NRBQ has been around just about as long as Peter Stanfill. Their initials stand for New Rhythm and Blues Quartet, but the music they make isn't straightforward rhythm and blues by any measure. NRBQ fans maintain that no album has ever captured what the band does on stage, and as someone who's seen them a few times, I have to agree. There just aren't recorded equivalents to, say, the night I watched pianist Terry Adams move from a Thelonious Monk composition into a keyboard version of Van Halen's Jump, or the evening NRBQ took nothing but requests from the audience, gamely playing any song anyone yelled out, which ranged from Purple Haze to Last Train to Clarksville. This sort of thing is by no means unusual for them, and it's one reason why they're not successful careerists. NRBQ is charmingly perverse. On this new album, Wild Weekend, their most alluring pop melody is addressed to a car.
I'll take you, registrate you. You know I'll never trade you. Fly, fly, fly. Go, go, go. Little float of go fast.
Given the band's two decades of wild eclecticism, the dedicated NRBQ fan may have difficulty taking the pretty tunes on this record at face value. This must be a joke, right? Pop irony, no? Well, no, I don't think so. I think that like everything else they do, when NRBQ decides to make an accessible record, they really put their hearts into it.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for The Village Voice, LA Weekly, and Spin.
A love that's all to us, a love we give in trust, a love that means so much, this love is true. Sometimes at night, when the sky...
This is Fresh Air. Anthropologist Richard Nelson spent years in the North living with and studying among Native Americans, but he spent the last few years exploring an island near his home in the Pacific Northwest. His book, The Island Within, is an account of his exploration. As he describes it, the island is big and mountainous, covered with forest and swamp-like meadows. Deer, mink, and brown bears are among the inhabitants. No people live on the island, but during World War II it was a military station, and rotted Quonset huts are the only reminder that other people were once there. In the preface to The Island Within, Nelson writes, "As time went by, I realized that the particular place I'd chosen was less important than the fact that I'd chosen a place and focused my life around it." I asked him how long it took him to realize that.
Oh, it took me quite a while, you know, after I'd been around the island for, a couple of years, I suddenly realized that I could think about this place as something special and maybe the most beautiful and wonderful place in the world, but then I realized that wasn't true at all, that every place in the world is as special as every other place, and what makes this one special for me is the relationship that I have to it, that it's my home. And I think it's a real important, it was a really important insight for me to recognize that any of us can have the same relationship to the place where we live. We just need to try to be there attentively and paying attention and loving the place.
Was this a particularly important realization for you because you'd spent so much time living in other people's homes and other people's territories as an anthropologist?
Oh, definitely. You know, you're in someone else's culture and in someone else's community. You never feel that you really belong there. You may be welcome there, and people are very kind to you. But I think it develops in you a deep yearning to have a home and to know that you belong there and to know that it's your place on earth. Especially because, for example, having lived with Native American people, they are so deeply rooted in their home, going back generation upon generation upon generation, living always in the presence of their ancestors and drawing on the knowledge of those ancestors. You begin to realize that we in Western culture have lost this deep sense of rootedness, not irretrievably. Of course, what drives me, I think, right now is a sense that we can regain this belonging and this home.
You talk about establishing a moral contract with the world. Elaborate on that.
Well, I learned about living in a sort of a moral, spiritual relationship to nature from elders of the Koyukon Athabascan Indians, whom I lived among for a couple of years. And for those people, everything in the natural world has a spirit, and everything is conscious and aware, so that if you're standing next to a tree, it knows you're there. And if you mistreat an animal, it becomes offended by this. Well, I never knew if this was literally true. I never knew if the spirit was really in things. But there seemed to be a deeper wisdom in that a person should behave as if it is, whether you know or not. And I think it's something that can apply to any of us. So I've tried to follow the Koyukon people's way of respecting animals, just as one way out of many, and think that people could choose their own gestures of respect toward nature as a constant reminder of where their life comes from and of the fragility of the earth and the need to treat the earth carefully.
Now, within this moral contract with the world, you hunt, and one of the animals you hunt is deer, and you're really in awe of deer. Is this a contradiction?
Well, I don't think so. I grew up in Wisconsin being opposed to hunting. I thought hunting was wrong and immoral. I learned how to hunt from Eskimo people in northern Alaska, and so it came to me as a way to make a living, not as a sport or recreation. And I found, especially living with Koyukon people, where this religious tradition is so intertwined with a hunting life, that there are ways of taking other lives and doing it with respect and humility. And I think each of us lives only at the behest of other lives. Even if we're vegetarians or whatever it is that we eat, it comes only from the earth, all of it. And so I think there's a special richness in being responsible for taking that life that gives you your own life.
Well, so how did you go about hunting deer, taking this into account?
Well, when I hunt, I try to be mindful that as Koyukon people would say, that the animal knows way more than you do, that you have to talk respectfully about it. If I'm going hunting, I don't say that's what I'm going to do. I just say I'm going to go out and look around. And then if I happen to get an animal, I always say thank you to the animal, and I always treat whatever parts of the animal I don't use carefully. I don't just throw things in the garbage. I take them back, like the bones, I always take back to the island and leave them there. Any parts that I don't use, I say, well, these are for the other animals. I should say that in doing these sorts of things, I'm not trying to imitate Native American people or to pretend that I am one. I'm trying to see if there's a universal wisdom here that applies to myself as a comfortably practicing member of my own Euro-American culture. If those principles can apply to me, then I feel, well, they can apply to any of us, to all of us, perhaps.
And what conclusion are you reaching?
Well, I guess what I think is that Native American people lived on the North American continent for thousands and thousands and thousands of years and did it in such a way that when the first Europeans arrived here, they mistakenly began calling it a wilderness. It was so pristine and so rich that it was hard for them to imagine anyone had ever lived here. And in thousands of years, I think that the Native American people developed an earthbound wisdom that is really, really so significant that we might do well to start trying to learn from it.
You write that in spite of all your contact with Native peoples that you've remained an agnostic.
Yes, I haven't tried to achieve some kind of orthodoxy in Native American beliefs. I just think that these principles are so wise and so profound and such good reminders to us of where our lives come from that they're worth following. You don't have to adopt some kind of a deep religious faith to do it. You just have to see that this is a wise way to live.
How do you make a living?
Well, such as it is, sometimes I teach, most recently at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I do little research projects on contracts. But when I was working on this book, which took years, I wrote full-time for 18 months, and I spent about 3 years on the island and worked from about 2,000 pages of journal material when I did the book. During most of that time, my partner, Nita, worked to support the research and the writing.
Ah, okay. In part of your book, you describe exploring Cluxa Mountain, which is on the island that you've been exploring, and during this time, your partner was away with her dying mother, dying of cancer. And I was wondering if you felt maybe that you were kind of out of balance emotionally at that point, seeking solitude and understanding the island while, you know, someone in your family was really ill.
It was a very difficult time. not, I was staying at home because our son was in school, and so Nita had to be with her mother, and I had to be home. It was kind of the way we divided the duties at that time.
I see.
But to be going out and having these adventures and these great times while other people were away amid such suffering was very difficult. But my time on the island ended up being just critical for me to try to come to grips with the death that was happening in our family. And I suppose in the long run, that was the most important thing that came for me out of this island experience, was a much better sense of what life and death meant for me personally.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried that with the writing of your book, The Island Within, that people will want to find this island that you consider so special?
Yes, that really concerns me. It seems to me that a lot of the nature and outdoor literature rests on a precarious balance between showing people where wonderful places are on the continent so people will care about keeping them in their wild state versus drawing crowds, such great crowds, to places that their specialness is destroyed. It's a balance that I have struggled profoundly with myself, and have chosen to preserve the anonymity of the place out of an ethical principle of respect toward it. Also, I think out of respect toward my readers. I think that everyone should have the same opportunity to discover this place as I discovered it, and as many people discovered it before me. And so one thing I would really like to see is a consideration of this in the whole community of people who read and write nature literature, that we need to develop a way to care about places without necessarily destroying their anonymity.
Mm-hmm. So how have you tried to preserve the anonymity of the island?
Well, the main way I've done it is by not talking about where it is, and by using place names that are not found on maps.
Mm-hmm.
Let's leave it at that.
Okay. Richard Nelson, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's a pleasure.
Richard Nelson is the author of The Island Within. It's published by North Point Press. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what they're putting together for us at All Things Considered and check in with Linda Wertheimer. Hi, Linda. What's coming up?
Hi, Terry. We're leading the show again with East Germany because the story is changing there so quickly. Mike Schuster will have a report from East Berlin. We also have a story from the United Nations that Nicaraguan Contras are meeting with members of the government to try to work out the ceasefire again. We've had an awful lot of letters about our coverage of Nicaragua, and we're going to be reading some of those letters on the program today. We also have a piece on tobacco companies advertising not about tobacco, which of course they can't, but about the Constitution.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Since 1873, Publishers Weekly has been the house organ of the book trade. It prints publishing news, gossip, and advance capsule reviews of new books. So it greatly influences what bookstores order, what reviewers review, and what the rest of us read. Lately, critic Maureen Corrigan has been thinking about the power of Publishers Weekly.
Sometimes the lists in Publishers Weekly are more fascinating to read than the books themselves. One recent issue recommended The Amazing Legume, which is a cookbook filled with low-cholesterol bean recipes, the 7-volume collected works of Mary Wollstonecraft, Sam Snead's autobiography called My Life on the Golf Course, and Save the Birds, a nonfiction book by Walter Cronkite that argues that if the birds die, we all die. You may think that this is a diverse list, but it's deceptive. Publishing is a conservative industry, so the books Publishers Weekly highlight usually belong to surefire, money-making categories. Canonized authors almost always receive positive blurbs, Books about Nazis are hot, so are self-help manuals and celebrity biographies. Even back in 1931, Publishers Weekly was recommending My Father, Mark Twain by Clara Clemens, probably one of the first tell-all biographies by a celebrity child. If a book doesn't obviously belong to an established category, Publishers Weekly will sometimes try to fit it into one so it will be more attractive to booksellers. My favorite example of this kind of imaginative reclassification is in a 1927 issue where a Publishers Weekly critic tried to hawk an odd book called The Future of an Illusion by referring to its author as the Sage of Vienna. This made Freud sound like just another self-help guru. By 1930, someone at Publishers Weekly must have read Freud because the magazine adopted a guilt tactic to market civilization and its discontents. Professor Dr. Sigmund Freud has written a new book. Those who have never read him, for one reason or another, no longer have an excuse not to do so. The new book, while brief, is packed with stimulating ideas. I'll say, ideas like the pathetic human quest for happiness, our instinctual hostility to culture. Civilization and its discontents is Freud's grand summing up of a lifetime of thinking, yet Publishers Weekly felt compelled to apologize for it because it was short by industry standards. The back issues of Publishers Weekly also make an important contribution to the current great books debate. They give us a glimpse into the grimy commercial origins of the classics and demonstrate that their alleged superiority wasn't always immediately apparent. In the summer issue of 1879, William Thackeray's Henry Esmond was featured in the same advertisement with an anonymous and higher-priced novel called That Awful Vicar. F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Beautiful and the Damned was touted in March of 1922 as a bully job. But the blurbs in that issue were much more enthusiastic about a bestseller entitled Ptomaine Street by Caroline Wells. Ptomaine Street probably had a more familiar plot. This makes me suspicious about a new novel Publishers Weekly recently recommended called The Comfort of Madness. It's narrated by a paralyzed catatonic patient in a mental hospital and sounds like a cross between Whose Life Is It Anyway and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I wonder what books we're not seeing because they don't appeal to the well-worn tastes of Publishers Weekly and the industry it represents.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Audrey Voblaitis, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Nancy Reagan about her family, astrology, and just saying no. Also, choreographer Elliot Fell tells us about making classic ballet and modern dance compatible. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.
Soloistic.
Yeah.